Next is State versus Stephen Bookman. If counsel could please step forward. May we please have appearances of counsel? Hang on one sec.
Good morning, Michael Hanson of Rolling Pins. Rolling Pins, the biggie on behalf of Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey as a friend of the court. Steve Morgan on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, also a friend of the court.
Deputy Attorney General Sarah Randolph for the state.
And I have just Ms. Randolph arguing on behalf of defendant. Ms. Randolph, please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Jennifer Randolph, designated pro bono counsel on behalf of defendant Stephen Bookman. Before I begin, may I please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you. Under both the Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Paragraph 7 of the New Jersey Constitution, warrantless entry into the home is permitted only if one of the narrow exceptions to the warrant requirement applies. Here, the trial court and the appellate division erroneously concluded that the hot pursuit exception to the warrant requirement justified officers' warrantless entry into 1237 Thurman Street, even where that entry was made in the attempted execution of a four-month-old traffic warrant for the arrest of a non-resident of that home at 1 a.m. It did not. Both the appellate division and the trial court grounded their determinations in this court's decision in State v. Jones, interpreting the court's decision in that case as effectively establishing a bright-line rule that police officers acting pursuant to a valid arrest warrant have the right to follow a fleeing suspect into a private residence, irrespective of the surrounding circumstances. For the reasons I will argue today, the lower court's application of Jones was incorrect, and the lower court's decision should be reversed. First, the Jones court did not establish a bright-line rule. The rule before Jones, in Jones, and today is that the evaluation of hot pursuit is a totality of the circumstances test. Second, the state's interpretation of Jones, permitting officers to enter without a warrant so long as officers are in possession of that valid arrest warrant and are pursuing a fleeing suspect, is inconsistent with the court's precedent. And finally, based upon the totality of the circumstances presented in this case, the officer's entry into 1237 Thurman Street was unconstitutional. To start, as the court is well aware, because officers did not have a search warrant for 1237 Thurman Street or an arrest warrant for a resident of that home, their conduct is presumptively unconstitutional absent the application of a narrow exception to the warrant requirement. Here, the state and the lower courts are relying on the hot pursuit exception to the warrant requirement, which permits warrantless entry only where officers are in immediate or continuous pursuit of a fleeing suspect who, during the course of that flight, creates exigent circumstances sufficient to support a warrantless home entry. As this court has made clear, because the hot pursuit exception to the warrant requirement is a subset of the exigent circumstances doctrine, the same touchstones that would justify warrantless entry in those circumstances are applicable here, including, for example, the threat of destruction of evidence or the threat of violence by the suspect. Importantly, what this court has made clear and what the Supreme Court recently reaffirmed is that hot pursuit alone is not sufficient to justify warrantless entry into the home. That was this court's decision in State v. Bull. The only additional circumstance present here is the existence of a valid arrest warrant for the arrest of Mr. Bell. The state takes the position that the court's holding in State v. Jones makes that additional circumstances, the presence of a valid arrest warrant alone, an exigency sufficient to justify warrantless entry. But that's not what the Jones court held. In Jones, the court was confronted with a situation in which officers observed Collier, non-defendant Collier, and the defendant, and recognized Collier as someone for whom they had an outstanding arrest warrant. This was a happenstance encounter, by chance, not a circumstance in which officers knew in advance the circumstances underlying that arrest warrant. in finding that that situation involved an exigency sufficient to warrant entry into the home, the court noted that the issuance of a warrant itself might indicate that a suspect has an arrest warrant outstanding for a grave offense. And the fact that an officer did not know that information at the time they attempted to execute the warrant shouldn't make their conduct unreasonable. But I think the most important part of Jones is the latter part of the opinion, in which the court made clear that it did not expect that its opinion would generate a rule that would permit warrantless entry anytime officers were in possession of a valid arrest warrant. The court said, under circumstances, and in fact provided an example, they said, if police are executing a warrant at a suspect's home, rather than on a fleeing suspect that they by chance happen to see on the street, we expect that the police will present the warrant at a proper hour and will knock and announce their presence at the suspect's door. That's precisely the circumstances here. Police were in possession of a valid traffic arrest warrant and chose to execute it at 1 in the morning with 8 state police officers descending upon this 1200 block of Thurman Street. Now, the state points to other circumstances in the record, including the fact that 2 hours earlier, a narcotics transaction had taken place, and the fact that Mr. Bell was the subject of an ongoing investigation.
So before you get to those two points, is there anything in the record that tells us why the police waited until 1 a.m.?
Your Honor, as I read the record, police were had seen the narcotics transaction and were briefing in order to go execute the traffic warrant, but there's no indication as to whether or not they thought that was the best time to find Mr. Bell or any of those other circumstances that might go to the reasonableness of the officer's conduct.
We know when the police were aware of the outstanding traffic warrant.
Your Honor, there's not a specific timeline in the record reflecting when officers became aware of the warrant itself, but Detective Rivera did testify that as the lead investigator in the motor vehicle theft investigation, it was his, as a matter of course, it was his, or in the ordinary course of his responsibilities, he would look into suspects, including checking to see whether they had a warrant. So to the extent that was a long-term investigation, as the record reflects, you can presume that officers had knowledge of this prior to 2 hours before, prior to the minutes before, which is the circumstances that the court was presented in Jones, a happenstance encounter with an individual for whom an outstanding arrest warrant existed.
Jones is different from this case. Tell me if I'm mistaken. In two respects, they may be important. One is Jones was arrested in his home, I think. Am I correct about that?
Your Honor, I'm not sure the record is clear that apartment 312 was the defendant. That's correct. I apologize.
There was a warrant for his arrest, and they arrested him in his home, which is constitutionally permissible, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, it's constitutionally permissible if the warrant is for the individual whose home it is. I do not think...
And this is different, but because the arrest warrant in this particular case was 1235, not 1237, and Bookman wasn't even on the warrant.
That's correct.
Correct? Mm-hmm. The other thing in Jones that is different from this case is that the officers in Jones did not know the basis for the arrest warrant. It could have been for an armed robbery or a rape or anything. They just knew that there was an arrest warrant, correct?
Precisely, Your
Honor. And in this case, they knew it was for an outstanding, $535 motor vehicle warrant?
Yes, Your Honor. It was for a bench warrant for failure to appear for a suspension of license.
They knew, in this case, it was for a violation, correct?
That's correct.
And they were going into a home that was not on the arrest warrant.
Precisely, Your Honor. Each of those circumstances, exactly as you describe, are what makes this case different from Jones and what the court in Jones contemplated, in fact. The court in Jones said, if this wasn't a by-chance meeting, the officer should be executing the warrant at a reasonable time and in a reasonable manner. In the course of that decision, they did recognize an officer's duty to effectuate arrest warrants. There's no question that officers don't have discretion in whether to execute a warrant, but they do.
So one of the differences is Jones is guided by a warrant. This is this is actually a warrantless entry, because the warrant was not for 1230. The arrest warrant was for 1235, and the officers are making a warrantless entry. So we have to look at our jurisprudence that deals with warrantless entries under exigent circumstances, correct?
Certainly, Your Honor, and that's what makes, I think that's why this case is here. Had defendant entered in his own home and police were attempting to execute arrest warrant, I don't think we would be before the court, as that has been resolved in cases like Peyton v. New York.
You're not suggesting that if it was in fact Mr. Bookman's home and he was the person this arrest warrant was for, that it's not a totality analysis. It's still I thought your argument was they had an arrest warrant for an individual they were chasing into another residence. All of those are factors, as Jones discusses, at 1 a.m. in the morning, after all these other things happen. These are all things that enter into that totality analysis, correct?
Precisely, Your Honor.
So there's no given answer or bright line rule that says what Justice Alvin's suggesting or the hypotheticals we're discussing somehow don't satisfy that test. We'd have to do a real factual deep dive into what happened, when it happened, and how it happened, and decide whether the conduct of the officer was objectively reasonable. That was a long question.
Your Honor is correct that the test...
The record, read that back.
Your Honor is correct that the test is one of the totality of the circumstances, but I think to start here, the issue is that below, they did read it as a bright-line rule. They read it as a bright-line rule that entry is permitted because officers had that valid arrest warrant.
You don't agree with that.
Correct?
You don't apparently agree with that.
Precisely, Your Honor, in large part because there is no bright-line rule, but also because it makes sense. Officers, you know, there has been, even more recently in the Supreme Court, in Lange v. California, the court discussed that flight of a misdemeanor isn't enough to warrant warrantless entry into the home.
But going back to Justice Solomon, in Lange, the court said totality of the circumstances, but they said two of the factors for exigency has to be a belief based upon rational reading of facts that there might be destruction of evidence or that someone might be subject to violence. So my question to you is there anything in the record from any of the witnesses to suggest that they feared that evidence would be destroyed or that someone's life would be placed in danger by chasing after this person who was wanted on a motor vehicle warrant?
No, Your Honor, there are no facts in the record to suggest that, and I think the facts suggest otherwise. In the state points to that narcotics transaction that took place the same day between Mr. Bell and an undercover officer. However, that was 2 hours before. There's no indication that the officers believed that Mr. Bell was currently in possession of whatever was the result of that narcotics transaction. And in fact, Detective Rivera testified that at the time that they executed the warrant, they believed that the CDS related to that transaction was inside the home of 1235 Thurman Street, for which they didn't have a search warrant. They only had an arrest warrant, a traffic warrant, for the arrest of Mr. Bell. So there's no indication that delay in executing the traffic warrant here would have even allowed that evidence related to the narcotics transaction to elude police, nor that delaying in executing the arrest warrant would have affected their investigation into their long-term investigation into the motor vehicle theft.
Tell me if I'm mistaken. During the course of the suppression hearing, they weren't justifying the arrest based upon a narcotics transaction because none of the officers had even witnessed it. Am I correct?
That is precisely correct, Your Honor. Both Detective Stymans and Detective Rivera testified that what they were doing when they got to 1200 Thurman Street was executing that traffic warrant that they had for the arrest of Mr. Bell.
And in fact, one of the witnesses said that he was guarding the back of 1235. The whole scheme was to make the arrest at 1235, no?
Precisely. I mean, the officers descended upon that block for the purposes of executing that arrest warrant. There was a certain contingent of those officers that were in the front. Detective Rivera was in the back for the purpose of executing that arrest warrant. There's nothing in the record to reflect that additional exigencies existed such that the warrantless entry into 1237 Thurman Street would have been constitutionally permissible.
I think the chief already asked this question, so forgive me if I'm repeating. There are references to the prior narcotics transaction and the long-term investigation in the record. Is there any discussion of either of those? I think Justice Alvin answered the first question. I guess not. Other than mentioning those two things, is there any discussion in the record at all about what this long-term investigation, what it was, but that they were at a point where they were going to take it down and they had probable cause, they had some reason to be in there? Is there anything in the record about that?
No, Your Honor. Particularly nothing that reflects that the officers believed they had probable cause to arrest on either of those bases. There is some discussion by the officers in the record that they were culminating their long-term investigation or that it was coming to a conclusion, but that's not sufficient to state that they had probable cause to arrest or even what the offense for which they would have been arresting Mr. Bell would have been. Nor is there any indication of the record as to the nature of that alleged narcotics transaction, including the type or quantity of any of the alleged narcotics.
Are those two investigations or the sale, alleged narcotics sale, long-term investigation, are they in any way relevant to the totality analysis?
No, Your Honor, not here, because they do not supply any additional exigency that would have justified warrantless entry. To the extent there was any indication during the course of the narcotics transaction, for example, that Mr. Bell is in possession of a weapon, maybe we'd be in a different scenario. Maybe we'd understand him to be armed and dangerous in entering this home. But that's not the facts on the record before us. What we know is that officers arrived at 1235 Thurman Street in an effort to execute this warrant at 1 in the morning, and no other exigencies exist that would have justified their entry into 1237. And that's all this court needs to look at. We don't need to overrule Jones or change the court's precedent. This is entirely consistent with the court's decision in Jones, with all of the Supreme Court precedent that leads up to it, and the state's proposed rule, which allows entry so long as officers are in pursuit of a fleeing suspect for whom they have a valid arrest warrant, is one that isn't consistent with that precedent, because it does ask for a bright line rule finding exigency so long as an arrest warrant exists. That's not this court's rule, and this court should reverse the appellate division and reverse defendant's conviction, which was based solely on this bright line rule that possession of the valid arrest warrant alone was sufficient to permit warrantless entry.
Other questions?
I have one question. Is there anything in the record that indicates that it is a practice of this police department or this law enforcement agency to execute violations of Title 39 cases in this fashion, where they eight police officers staffed and deployed at 1 o'clock in the morning? Is there anything on the record that says that that's a common policy of that department?
No, Your Honor, not to the best of my recollection, there's no indication in the record of the practices of the office being to execute.
Is it your position that the warrant was used as pretextual just to provide some means of arresting the defendant for other than violations of Title 39?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think that was effectively the officer's testimony, is that they were executing this traffic warrant in order to assist in the conclusion of their motor vehicle and theft investigation. Though, obviously, the inquiry into hot pursuit and exigent circumstances is one of objective reasonableness, so I'm not sure we can consider the subjective intent of the officers, but do I believe it was pretextual? The answer is yes.
What came of that long-term investigation, do you know?
Your Honor, I'm actually not familiar with the outcome of that investigation, but the outcome obviously isn't relevant to what the officers knew at the point in time that they arrived upon 1200.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Nothing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Shalom.
It please the court. I'd like to begin by directing you to the seventh transcript, page 89, I believe. There's a discussion about the timing of the warrant, and surrounding that, there is also a question about the purpose and what were you doing. And, oh yeah, we wanted to bring him in to talk to him. But let me just read a couple lines from page 89. Question: so the real purpose in arresting Julian Bell wasn't because he had an outstanding warrant. If that were the case, you would have done it much earlier in the investigation. Answer, this is line 13, no, because he was a suspect of that investigation and we weren't going to compromise the investigation just for an ATS warrant. So that is, I think, a critical passage for a few reasons. The first is it undermines a conclusion in Smith, in Jones, that once there's a warrant, officers are duty-bound to execute it immediately. And to be clear, Jones never says immediately, and I think that's the key, is that they're duty-bound to enforce it, but not duty-bound to do it right away. But it also really belies the fundamental contention of the states, which is, well, how could we ask officers to decide whether a warrant is a serious one for an armed robbery or a not serious one for this traffic court thing? Well, they already made that conclusion when they chose not to enforce it earlier on. Do we think that the theft of ATVs would have prevented them from executing an arrest warrant for a murder? Of course not. They know how to make those decisions, and that's why, and I agree with the able presentation of defense counsel, we don't have to overrule Jones. We can say in Jones, they didn't know what the warrant was for, and here they did. And when they do, then what they have to be able to do is moor the risks inherent in that warrant to the purposes of hot pursuit. So destruction of evidence, or risk of officer safety, or escape. And so the state seems to have two alternate theories. One is it would be too hard to ask officers to draw these lines, but here we know they already have. And the other is that either of the proposed lines, I believe the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers said, let's look at ATS versus not ATS warrants. And the ACLU's brief said, let's look at superior court versus municipal court. And they said, but look, there are serious things that happen in traffic court, like DWI. And there are serious things that happen in municipal court, like harassment or simple assault. And I think we could have a serious debate about whether those things are sufficiently serious.
Our case law has already drawn that line.
Agreed.
We have Bolt and Welsh, now we have Lang. And for minor violations, you're not going to have the same exigency for entering a home as you would if it was a serious felony.
Without a doubt, I think that is absolutely clear. And I think the only thing that I think is interesting, or not the only thing, I think the next step the court has to ask, because I think this case can be decided very clearly because the officers knew it was an ATS warrant. But what do we also want to avoid a situation where law enforcement becomes willfully blind to the nature of what are in warrants. And they just say, I knew there was a warrant. And the reason we must do that, and the court must provide some guidance, is because the court, through its Supreme Court Committee on Municipal Court Operations, Fines, and Fees, noted that there were 2.5 million open warrants in New Jersey. And I know the court has taken some impressive and significant steps since then to reduce that number. But we're still talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of warrants. And if the state's very extreme reading of Jones is good, then that gives them opportunity to enter hundreds of thousands,
We're one step away from Jones, because Jones was dealing with a warrant for a suspect in his residence. And that was Lang, too. Even in Lang, the question of, and in Welsh, there was a question of whether or not you can go into the person's residence. We're talking about a third party's residence.
Justice Albin, I always like to take the softballs that you give me. I actually am not as confident in Jones that it was Collier's residence. I think there is some suggestion in Jones that it is, and some suggestion that he may have lived in the building and they didn't know the apartment. Certainly, the fact that it doesn't matter what Jones said. This is a third party's home. And so all of the questions that Justice Solomon alluded to about totality of the circumstances and deciding whether or not it was reasonable are right. But because it's a third-party home, we start from the point of it being a presumptively unreasonable search, because it lacks a search warrant, and it's not the person's home. I think that pretty much sums it up, unless the court has any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shlum. Mr. Barton.
So, thank you, Chief. Thank you, Justices. So let me pick up with where Justice Albin left off, because I'm looking at page 15 of the Jones decision, and I do believe that this was Collier's home based upon the Supreme Court's decision. And I'm just reading into the record at 15. In contrast, the officers in this case were making an in-home arrest, albeit for a minor offense, pursuant to a valid arrest warrant issued upon probable cause. And the next sentence goes on to say, the valid arrest warrant provided a limited authority to enter a dwelling in which Collier lived. So I would agree with Justice Albin that this is a fundamentally different case, because here there's no question that 1237 Thurman Street was not the home of Mr. Bookman. And so defense counsel said earlier, which is 100% accurate, that our reading is fully consistent with precedent. And I would point the court specifically to State v. Johnson and Stiegold v. United States. Because when you're effectuating an arrest warrant at the home of a third party, you need either consent, a search warrant, or exigent circumstances. Certainly, as your honors all know at this point, there was no consent, there was no search warrant, and we would submit that there were no exigent circumstances. And I say that because the record is pretty plain, and Mr. Shalom mentioned this a few moments ago, as did defense counsel, that this warrant for Mr. Bell was outstanding for at least 4 months before the state police even attempted to effectuate it. And so when you're looking to precedent in this case, Bolt in particular, Lang, Welsh, the fact of the matter is there could not be any possibility of evidence destruction. This had to do with driving with the suspended license that happened months ago. Any evidence happened at the scene of the stop. Certainly there was no threat of evidence destruction 4 or 5 months later. Nor could there be any real threat to public or officer safety, because as we are all aware, a traffic violation, a Title 39 violation, is neither a felony nor is it a misdemeanor. It's not a crime. It's a violation. So the argument—
Let me ask you about that last point, because sure. is there bright line law that says a traffic violation can never represent a threat to officer safety? It seems to me, just anecdotally, that there are traffic violations that end up with officers being killed.
Of course, but the key, Justice Patterson, here is a passage of time. So certainly a traffic violation can't be a threat to officer or public safety 4 months after the fact.
Why is that? I mean, are you saying that that just can't happen? Someone who has traffic violation and who is armed and is served with a warrant for a traffic violation can't represent a threat to officer safety? I'm not talking about the facts of this case. I understand you're here talking about the facts of this case.
But
that sounded a lot like a bright line rule, and I don't see that anywhere.
It's certainly not anywhere in the precedent. There's not need for a bright line rule to decide this case in favor of Mr. Bookman.
No, but my point is that you seem to be saying that if as we go down the sliding scale of seriousness of offenses and we get to traffic violations, and there is a delay between the issuance of the warrant and the execution of the warrant, there can't be a threat to officer safety.
It would be hard for me to fathom a situation where months after the fact for a warrant for driving with a suspended license or not having windshield wipers on when lights were on, that particular individual would pose.
Driving with a suspended license can have some serious consequences to someone, depending on their history, right?
No question. But again, it's hard for me to separate things from time of the stop and months later time effectuating an arrest warrant. So that would almost presuppose that anyone who would have a minor traffic violation, and I would imagine no one in this courtroom is exempt, somehow poses a threat to officer safety.
I'm not saying all the time, but what you, but the way you presented that was, well, of course we know there's no threat to officer safety because it's a minor violation and because there's a passage of time. It just seems to me that there is room for circumstances in these cases that, that where it may in fact represent a threat to officer safety. You could have someone who they have a report is armed, angry over the DWI, angry over the driving with a suspended license, where there could be a serious threat.
Well, I mean, if they were armed, then there would be presumably a commission of a separate crime if there was reports that they were armed. I guess my point would be looking back to Bolt or Welsh, if there wasn't fear of officer safety or destruction of evidence moments after someone went into their home, presumably intoxicated or otherwise, then I don't know how there would be a threat months after the fact. But again, I'm sorry.
And as we've been discussing here, the analysis is the totality of circumstances. It's a really fact-sensitive analysis for every specific case. So there might possibly be some case, but in talking about this case where, you know, there's a failure to appear months later, as the facts are here in this case, looking at the totality of the circumstances, there really was no fear or threat of officer safety, considering what occurred in this particular case. And in every case, we'd be looking at the specific facts, correct?
I don't think there's any question that everyone is employing a totality of the circumstances test here. And so to, I guess, pivot from Justice Patterson's question, ultimately here, looking at these facts based upon the record, as I think we all understand it, this is an ATS warrant that is effectuated months after it issued. There was no reasonable probability of evidence destruction. There was no reasonable probability based upon this warrant that the officer or officer safety was jeopardized or public safety was in any way in jeopardy. And so I come back to the very fundamental point that what the appellate division here did was really ignore key factual differences in Jones and also ignore both this court's precedent in Johnson and also U.S. Supreme Court precedent in Stiegold, because this was the home of a third party, 1237 Thurman Street.
Had there been evidence in the record of imminent harm to others, a threat to officer safety or destruction of evidence, that might present a different question. But we don't have that here.
Absolutely correct.
Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Fartin?
No, Chief. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Brigham.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The state has four main points in response. First, defendant's suggestion that officers were merely executing a four-month-old traffic warrant here is factually inexact. Bell, the subject of the arrest warrant, was a suspect in a long-term ATV and motorcycle theft investigation that the police was culminating that night. And there is support for that in the motion record, specifically Detective DeFergilich's testimony that said the police was trying to conclude that long-term investigation, which is at 2T49-22 to 50-3. They also went to Bell's home to apprehend him. And when the police arrived, Detective Simons tried to arrest Bell outside while he was standing out front with defendant and another male. But despite the detective saying, stop, state police, and Jewel, stop, Bell ran into a third-party home to evade apprehension. And it was Bell's actions that took this public encounter into a private place. Under the circumstances, the officer's entry here in hot pursuit of a fleeing subject of an arrest warrant was lawful under this court's longstanding precedent of Jones, which holds that officers acting pursuant to a valid arrest warrant have the duty and right to follow the fleeing subject into a private residence, whether the warrant is for a minor or serious offense. Which leads me to my second point. It's unclear in Jones whether the subject of the arrest warrant was fleeing into his home or into a third party's home. The court, in summarizing the facts, merely referred to the home as apartment 312, and that's at pin site 9. Also at pin site 10, the court noted how another co-defendant was indicted in this case based on stuff that was found in the apartment, so it could very well have been this other third-party co-defendant's home. Again, it's unclear in the opinion. And at page 15, what the ACDL was citing was merely citing the generally applicable law. Yes, if it was Collier's home, which is the arrest warrant subject home under Payton, the arrest warrant implicitly gives the limited authority to go inside that home when there's reason to believe in that subject's inside. But Jones then goes on to hold that it's also lawful and that officers acting pursuant to a valid arrest warrant have both the duty and right to pursue the fleeing suspect into a private residence. They could very well have said the homeowner's residence, but they didn't. They said a private residence. And now going on to my third point, Lange, which merely adopted a standard that already existed in the state from Bolt for decades, did not overrule Jones, a case that distinguished Bull's warrantless arrest circumstances from its warrant-based arrest. Unlike Lange and Bolt, which both involved suspects fleeing from warrantless arrests, Jones addresses the exact scenario that is presented here. Officers who are dutifully pursuing the fleeing subject of an arrest warrant in hot pursuit and is therefore dispositive. My fourth and final point is, as this court already held in Jones, it should not matter if the arrest warrant is for a minor or serious offense for the police to dutifully pursue the fleeing subject from a warrant-based arrest inside. A non-indictable arrest warrant suggests that the arrest warrant subject has ignored less intrusive process and thereby inherently presents a heightened risk of evading arrest. And whether an arrest warrant was issued for a minor or serious offense does not change the fact that the probable cause determination for that warrant was made by a neutral and detached judicial official, and that the issued warrant imposes a duty to enforce that warrant without distinction. To require the police know the offenses underlying every warrant, and then whether or not a given offense is a minor one, would be unworkable, and it would unjustifiably interfere with the police's principal function of arresting those wanted on outstanding arrest warrants. As this court recognized in Jones, every arrest, regardless of the nature of the offense, may present a risk of danger to an officer. And if Jones were not the law, the subject of a minor arrest warrant could continue evading arrest by defiantly fleeing into strangers' homes. This court should not condone a rule that would turn apprehension of subjects of such warrants into a race depending on who's fleetest foot. And so at this time, the state would be happy to answer any questions the court may have.
Do you agree that hot pursuit doesn't justify a warrantless entry into a home in all cases? You need to look for exigency in light of the totality of the circumstances.
Yes, that's true. But when the person is fleeing from a warrant-based arrest, that's the inherent exigency that justifies the hot pursuit entry.
So hold off for just a moment on that. Is there anything other than the flight that you rely upon here to establish exigency?
No, it's also relying on the warrant-based arrest. It has to be flight from a warrant-based arrest that triggers that inherent exigency that justifies the hot pursuit entry.
So nothing about the other investigations, about the earlier narcotics transaction, that has no bearing on the outcome in this case. Is that correct?
The reason why the state pointed out those facts is because defendant was trying to make this into a case that the officers were merely executing a traffic warrant at 1 a.m., and that's just simply not true.
But they were executing a traffic warrant at 1 a.m. Did they have a warrant for the other long-term investigation?
No, they didn't.
Did they have a warrant for the supposed hand-to-hand that was observed hours prior?
No, they did not.
So they only had a warrant for the failure to appear in traffic court, and that's what they were executing?
That is correct. However, the reason why they were going to the house that night is because they were culminating that long-term investigation.
But does that play into the totality of the circumstances?
It goes to show how the officer's actions were objectively reasonable, which is a limitation on the Jones rule.
And what came of that investigation? Would we need to know more about that investigation in order to consider that a basis for a warrantless entry here?
No, I don't believe so. I think the fact that they were culminating the investigation that night shows how going there at 1 a.m. was objectively reasonable.
What does that mean, culminating the investigation? Were charges filed?
Yes, charges were filed in that investigation. Right. The trial testimony reveals that they expected Bell to be arrested with three other suspects in this investigation, and Bell didn't happen to be there. So they were culminating this investigation, bringing in several people, and that
When did the investigation actually culminate?
That night.
They arrested Bell for the long-term theft investigation that night?
They tried to bring Bell into custody for the purpose of that investigation and executing the ATS warrant. However, Bell evaded apprehension.
When did they get a warrant? When did they submit and have a judge rule on a proposed complaint?
I do not know the answer to that question, Your Honor. On the basis of the theft, and I don't know the specific date when. I do know that charges were filed in connection with the ATF and theft investigation. I just don't know when they were filed.
Let's come back to this evening. Mm-hmm. Other than the flight, when the officer says stop and Bell does not, what do you rely on for exigency?
The fact that Bell is fleeing from a warrant-based arrest, and the fact that warrant-based arrest began in a public place. The officers tried to arrest Bell while he was standing outside the home, and Bell's the one who took this public counter into a private place.
Please finish.
And under the totality of circumstances where they were culminating that investigation, where Bell's fleeing from a warrant-based arrest, the officers dutifully went inside
I hate to belabor this point. Culminating. Does culminating mean that they had sufficient evidence to file charges against him for the auto theft and for the drugs at 1 a.m. or 10 hours earlier? Like, what do you mean by culminating? Was it culminated? Did they have enough evidence to charge him then? Only if you can answer it. I don't want you speculating.
I would be speculating from
then,
there, but...
Then don't do it. Go ahead.
I'm not going to speculate, but I will tell Your Honor what's in the motion record. In the motion record, they didn't have an arrest warrant for Bell's arrest based on investigation, but the motion testimony does say that Bell was a suspect in that investigation that they were concluding that night, and that was one of the reasons why they went to his home, to take him into custody
for
that investigation.
On a motor vehicle violation for a traffic warrant. I'm looking at the pages that you gave to us from Detective Virgilius. Mm-hmm. So the only arrest warrant that you had was the traffic warrant for $525. The answer, that's correct. And then he said, question, 1237 was not the residence listed on the arrest warrant, correct? I don't remember. And then it goes on. Did you see the arrest warrant in the case? And then the court said it's been admitted into evidence. It's 1235. 1235 was the arrest warrant, correct?
Correct. That's
good. That arrest warrant does not permit you to go to search another house. Do you agree? You need a search warrant to search a third party house. That's what Stiegold says, correct?
That's correct.
So putting aside the flight and hot pursuit, the warrant standing alone, did not give the police the right to enter 1237. For that, they needed a search warrant, correct?
The warrant alone wouldn't justify the entry into a third-party home. It's the fleeing from that warrant-based arrest that justifies the hot pursuit.
Yeah, it's the hot entry. So you're relying on hot pursuit, exigent circumstances, not the warrant, because the warrant doesn't permit you to go in. You need a search warrant to go in. So you need an exception to the warrant requirement. One of those is hot pursuit, correct?
Correct.
So under that, is there evidence in the record of destruction, imminent destruction of evidence?
There's not evidence of imminent destruction of evidence.
Evidence of a threat to the safety of one of the officers or to anyone else?
I would argue yes. There was danger in fleeing from the warrant-based arrest, and that's partly because a minor warrant signifies, as I was explaining in my opening, that the subject has ignored less intrusive process like a summons, and then thereby inherently presents a heightened risk of invading arrest.
So if that position is correct, then these hundreds of thousands of outstanding warrants would provide a basis for exigency if an individual didn't stop and fled.
That is correct. That's because the fleeing from the warrant-based arrest is the inherent exigency, and it doesn't require an additional showing. Lange did not overrule this court's longstanding precedent. Lange holds that an additional showing is required when a misdemeanor suspect flees from a warrantless arrest. The distinction here is that the subject was fleeing from a warrant-based arrest.
Lang went into his home. So that's the reason why we don't get into the third party. But I want to ask you this question, because we have these thousands and thousands of motor vehicle, low-level motor vehicle warrants out. And let's say it's for the house. Is it your position that the police can enter the home by any and all means to effectuate the arrest for, let's say, a $500 fine, which includes taking a ramrod and smashing down the door and entering with guns raised? Is it your position that that could be done for motor vehicle violations?
It depends on the totality of circumstances. As Jones holds, the main test always remains whether the officers are acting objectively.
Jones,
reasonably.
No. Jones isn't helpful here, in my view, because the pursuing officers had no idea what the arrest warrant was for. In their mind, it could have been for the most serious felony imaginable. Here, the officers do know. So let's talk about in cases where they do know, not where they don't know. Where they do know, it's for a very minor traffic offense. Do they have a right? And I'm not even talking about a third party's home, the suspect's home, to smash down the door in order to effectuate the arrest.
Again, it depends on the totality of circumstances, whether those would objectively justify.
I gave you the circumstances, so take those as the circumstances. They don't have any other information other than the person, and he didn't pay a $500 fine. Those are the circumstances. Under those circumstances, and they don't have anything more. They have the arrest warrant. Can they smash down the door and effectuate the arrest?
I have a response. One, I would like to respond to your honor's specific hypothetical question, and the second, I would also like to answer why it doesn't matter if the officers know the basis of the warrant in advance. To answer your honor's question first, that use of force, again, I may be repeating myself, but it depends on the circumstances. And even in Jones, it was a forceful entry where the officers kicked in the door. So yes, when a subject is fleeing from a warrant-based arrest, it may be objectively reasonable for the officers to use force to effect that arrest warrant. Now I'm going to answer why it shouldn't matter if the officers know the basis of the warrant or not. And I have, okay. First reason, even though the officers know the basis of the warrant in advance, that doesn't give them probable cause in advance to get a search warrant to enter into every third-party home in the surrounding neighborhood when they're going to a person's home to try to effect his valid arrest warrant. Second, where officers properly start the warrant-based arrest in a public place like here, and then the fleeing subject finally takes the public encounter into a private home, officers have to make split-second decisions under swiftly folding circumstances and do not have time to apply a multi-factor test, which I'm now going to transition into why the additional requirements of Lange shouldn't apply here. And one of the reasons is because the minor warrant itself signifies that the subject has ignored less intrusive process and is more highly likely to evade that arrest. But in addition to that, the additional requirements in Lange are not needed to serve as a temporary check on the arresting officer's discretion because the warrant itself signifies that a neutral and detached judicial official has already made the probable cause determination separate from the officer. So going back to Lange, where we were dealing with the suspect fleeing from a warrantless arrest, there was no tempering check on the officer's discretion to make that warrant-based entry. But there was that tempering check here because a judge found probable cause for that warrant to issue for Bell's arrest. And the fleeing from that warrant-based arrest, it defiantly ignoring the officer's command to stop was the inherent exigency that justified the hot pursuit entry.
So you keep mentioning inherent exigency that justified the entry into the third party's home because this was a warrant-based arrest. So by virtue of the fact that this is a warrant-based arrest and defendant and Bell fled, that there was an inherent exigency and we don't need to think about anything else. But then you also mentioned the totality of the circumstances. So what is your argument here? Because it seems like you're arguing that there was a warrant, he fled, so that gave the police the authority to go into this third party's home, period. Is that your argument?
That is my argument. However, the law of Jones, I'm saying this is what the Jones doctrine is, that's sufficiently limited in two ways. The first is being, and I've said it before, but I'm going to say it again. The main test always remains whether the officers are acting objectively reasonable. So if there's a case where the officers aren't acting objectively reasonably, the hot pursuit entry would not be justified.
So in this case, I know we're talking about other cases where, Jones, they didn't know what the warrant was. In this case, the officers knew what the warrant was. They knew that this was a warrant for a minor traffic violation. You know, you talk about the fact that the officers are duty-bound to make the arrest, that the fact that this was a four-month open warrant shows that, Bell is someone who will likely evade apprehension. But when you look at the facts of this case, we know that the officers had been observing him. They knew where he was. They saw him earlier in the day. This was not a case in which the officers had no idea where this person was, and if they didn't execute this warrant immediately, they would never find him again. They knew where he was. They made the choice not to execute that warrant, correct? I mean, that's what we have in the record, correct?
I think Your Honor is looking at this from the perspective of the ATS warrant instead of looking at the totality of circumstances. And yes, the officers had been keeping tabs on Bell. He was a suspect in this long-term investigation. That's why he was a person of interest to the police. They were concluding that investigation that night. And
know,
they
but
did.
But again, they didn't have a warrant for that. They did not have a warrant for that investigation. I know. I have the transcript right here where the officers say, yes, we were concluding the investigation and we had a warrant, so we were going to find him at 1 o'clock in the morning. That's part of the calculus as well as to whether the officers acted reasonably in the circumstance. Jones indicates that there's an expectation that officers are going to act reasonably in executing warrants. Is it reasonable? Is this the type of investigative technique that the state thinks it should be condoned to execute a traffic warrant at 1 o'clock in the morning, for a suspect that they had eyes on, that they had seen previously, in this type of circumstance, and going into a third party home? Is that reasonable? That's part of the analysis, correct?
The circumstances here were reasonable. It was reasonable for the officers to try to attempt an arrest Bell while he was outside his home. It's Bell himself that took this encounter into a private place, creating this exigency that necessitated the officers following him in hot pursuit. If he hadn't fled, this arrest would have taken place in a public place. We wouldn't even have to worry about the hot pursuit doctrine. The arrest would have happened outside permissibly, but it's Bell himself who's running into that third party home.
That's if you consider evading a motor vehicle offense and going to someone's home. It's an exigency, or whether or not the police going into the home created an exigency, as is evidenced by one of the officers going, finding someone in a bedroom, like waking up to police officers. A person who lives in 1237 is waking up to a police officer in the dead of the night. That's one of the reasons why the Supreme Court of the United States required a search warrant to go into a third party's home, because of the invasion of their rights, privacy rights. The guy who was waking up in the middle of the night.
The guy who was waking up in the middle of the night, I just want to be clear, was not defendant. Defendant fled with Bell into the third-party home.
No, I understand that. But the Constitution protects the rights of third parties, his home. That's a private sanctuary for him.
It does protect a third-party homeowner's interests, and they were actually protected here. The hot pursuit doctrine, where on the basis of a fleeing subject, fleeing from a warrant-based arrest, is adequately cabined in two ways. I didn't get to my second way before. The first one is because the officers always have to act objectively reasonably. The second reason is that hot pursuit entry doesn't justify a search of the premises. It justifies looking in areas where the subject could be hiding, to bring him to arrest him and bring him into custody. As soon as the officers find that arrest warrant subject and arrest him, the hot pursuit exigency ends, and they immediately have to go outside the home unless another exception to the warrant requirement applies. So the facts that you just described, Justice Albin, that was reasonable under the hot pursuit doctrine, because the entry was justified by the hot pursuit, and that hot pursuit exigency existed, justifying the officers scanning the home for the arrest warrant subject.
We don't have to worry about what takes place inside the home until there's a determination that the officers had the right under hot pursuit to get into the home.
That's correct.
And in this case, I think some of the questioning that you're hearing reflects the artificial nature of what took place. Hot pursuit is designed to protect officer safety, protect safety of the public, guard against destruction of evidence. Here, we have 8 officers at 1 a.m. after deliberate, careful thought, deciding they were going to execute a failure to appear in municipal court. That's not the usual set of circumstances that the court deals with. The municipal court report that the ACLU alluded to earlier spoke to, at that time, millions and now a smaller number, but a substantial number of outstanding warrants that the report, in response to Judge Fuentes' question earlier, the report said, we don't expect officers, with their lack of resources and with the other important things on their plates, to be pursuing these minor offenses. And that's why they stayed on the books for 5, 10, 20 years. Here, the position, or let me ask it this way, is the position of the Attorney General that officers could take a list of all those outstanding arrest warrants from municipal court for failures to appear and do what happened here time and again in Camden, as took place in this case. And if somebody doesn't stop, as they should, when they're asked, when they're directed, stop police, go into third-party homes without a warrant. Is that the Attorney General's position? Because that could flow from a ruling in your favor.
So the analysis that I'm applying could justify that. However, officers aren't going to take a list of hundreds of thousands of standing failure to appeal warrants and then go out and try to find those people and bring those in on the failure to appear warrants like Your Honor is suggesting.
But what, you want to do it selectively in cases like this.
In cases...
Is that problematic?
No, it's not problematic. It's not problematic here. It's not problematic because the circumstances here shows why that could be reasonable in certain circumstances. The circumstances here being Bell was part of this long-term ATV and theft investigation. And of course the officers aren't going to immediately affect the ATS warrant as soon as it came up in June 2017, which by the way, it's unclear from the record when the officers knew about this ATS warrant, whether it was a week before this investigation was concluding or whether they knew it right away in June of 2017. However, it makes sense why they didn't execute the ATS warrant as the failure to appear warrant as soon as they knew about it, because that would have jeopardized their theft investigation. Yeah, and it's not.
Why at 1 a.m.? Look, 1 a.m., eight people, and they're securing the back residence, as was suggested by defense counsel. It's not that we have to reach this issue, but it seems clear that the officers wanted to gain entry into the house based upon this particular warrant. Eight officers at 1 a.m., you typically would expect the person to be at home at 1 a.m. Go ahead. I know you're shaking your head. No. Okay. Tell me why no.
The reason why 1 a.m. is because they tried taking Bell into custody earlier that night, but he wasn't with other suspects that they intended to take him into custody with in relation to this investigation. But they've now sounded the alarm by taking these other people into custody, and then necessitated taking in Bell that night, and after, which is why they went to his house at 1 in the morning to try to take him into custody.
Is this in the record, what you're telling us now?
It's in the part about trying to, they intended on arresting him with other suspects. That's in the trial testimony. However, what's in the motion record, and I know Your Honor looked up the site that I provided in my opening, and the purpose of that site was to show how that investigation was concluding that night. There's other citations in the motion record that support that the officers were going to the home in relation to this investigation. And the other justifying factor was they had this arrest warrant. So and those...
The multiple references during the course of the argument to this long-term investigation that was culminating that night, How long was this long-term investigation?
Trial testimony shows it was a six-month-long investigation.
And long-term investigations typically end with an application made to a neutral and detached magistrate for arrest warrants and or search warrants. Not watching someone on the street and arresting after a six-month investigation. Did that happen in this case?
The motion record's unclear what steps, all the steps the officers took in relation to that investigation, and I honestly, I don't know all the circumstances leading up to that investigation, apart what's in the motion and in the trial testimony. Would Your Honor mind repeating the question again? I'm sorry.
I'm not sure what weight the long-term investigation has in the analysis here. Help us understand.
Because it shows why the officer's actions were objectively reasonable in going there at 1 in the morning. However, I would like to point out that, say we have different circumstances here where where the officers were on a patrol at 1 in the morning and they happened to see somebody standing outside at that late hour and they recognize who that person is and they run a warrants check on them and have and the warrants check shows that there is a warrant for that person. While that person is outside in a public place, it would be reasonable for the officers to then enforce that warrant and take that person into custody. The reason why the hot pursuit doctrine applies here is because the subject of the arrest warrant, when that arrest was effectuated in a public place, took it inside a private place to evade apprehension, creating the exigency for the officers to follow the arrest warrant subject and arrest him in hot pursuit.
What in the record, because my only recollection is there is a statement, discussion, whatever, that they were going to take down this long-term investigation. Other than that, I don't remember seeing anything. What in the record explores what that long-term investigation was and that's what they were doing that night, just not executing the search warrant? In other words, to justify the conduct of the officers here, what was explored with respect to the long-term investigation or the two-hour prior CDS event?
So Detective Steinmetz, I'm going to go by each officer's testimony. Detective Steinmetz, the citation is 2T11-20 to 12-4. He testified that he was assisting in an interstate theft investigation and Bell was wanted in that investigation. And it was brief that Bell had a traffic warrant and an undercover officer saw him with cocaine. Detective Rivera's testimony, which is at 2T19-13 to 20-5, testified that the police were investigating Julian Bell that night for a long-term investigation regarding the theft of motorcycles and ATVs. Detective DeFragile's testimony, I've already provided one citation there, but another citation is 2T41-6 to 42-8. He testified, quote, "We were going to 1235 Thurman Street in an attempt to look for Bell based on a long-term investigation that we were conducting with him as a suspect. He was a suspect of a stolen motorcycle investigation, and we were looking for him for those charges that we were going to arrest him on, and we knew he had an outstanding ATS warrant out of Deptford Township." Then the judge's motion findings, fact findings, which is at 3T30-9 to 31-6, said or found at that time, members of the New Jersey State Police were on scene to locate Mr. Bell, who was a suspect in an investigation regarding stolen motorcycles and had an active warrant out of Deptford Township.
Except, without the warrant that they had, would they have been justified in pursuing Mr. Bell?
Inside in hot pursuit?
Yes.
If they didn't have the arrest warrant, the Bell would have been ignoring a police command to stop, which I believe is an indictable crime under instruction and of obstruction. And if I'm correct that it's an indictable crime of obstruction, then it would be a warrantless arrest from an indictable crime that may have justified the hot pursuit entry.
So
anytime
someone ignores a command, that can justify hot pursuit.
That's not what the state is. The state doesn't want to go that far in this case based. That's a very broad answer. The state doesn't want to go that far in this case, but focusing on the facts of the circumstances here, you have Bell, who's the suspect in a long-term investigation that the officers were trying to conclude that night. Bell was outside his home, so he was in a public place. And while Bell was outside in that public place is when Detective Steinman said, stop state police, and tried to take him into.
They had a warrant. Let's go back to Justice Solomon's question, because I'm not certain that you answered it. Put aside the warrant. Did they have probable cause to arrest him for anything else? And when I say that, based on the testimony, did anyone testify, yeah, we had probable cause to arrest him for this auto theft, we had probable cause to arrest him for the drug? Did anyone say that?
The officers didn't testify that they had probable cause to arrest for anything else, but they could have had probable cause to arrest for that hand-to-hand drug transaction, but.
Could have. That's not the question I'm asking. Because did they have probable, did any of them say, yeah, I had probable cause to arrest for the drug thing that not one of these testifying officers observed? Did any of them testify, yeah, we had probable cause to arrest?
No, because the focus was on the fact that they were concluding that investigation and they had that outstanding arrest warrant.
So the only basis to make the arrest was this outstanding traffic warrant. That's it. He may have been a suspect, but no one is claiming that they had probable cause to make an arrest for anything else, correct? And if they, correct?
Yes, the basis.
And if they didn't have that arrest warrant, and they would have no basis to tell them to stop, like on with respect to the other stuff. Like why would, they wouldn't have been out there at 1 o'clock in the morning, would they?
To answer the first part of Your Honor's question, yes, the basis for the hot pursuit entry here is the fleeing from the arrest warrant. That's the basis for the hot pursuit entry that the state is advocating for. To answer the second part of your question, on the basis of these facts, it doesn't appear that they would have been there at 1 in the morning had they not been culminating that long-term investigation.
On that second point, culminating is not a term that supports probable cause. Had you gone to a judge that night and said, Your Honor, we've conducted a 6-month long-term investigation into XYZ. We are planning to culminate it tonight. May we have a warrant? Would you get a warrant? That's all you're telling the judge. You're about to culminate a long-term investigation. Can a judge issue a warrant under that presentation?
You need to show the basis for probable cause.
Precisely. So simply to stand up and argue to the court they were out there to culminate an investigation does not provide probable cause.
But
cannot provide a basis for an arrest, can it?
But you don't need probable cause to go outside someone's home and seeing if they're outside to effect an arrest warrant. You don't need probable cause to do that.
So, and that's precisely the nature of the questioning you're hearing. This case sounds like it turns on the flight, not about anything else. Is that unfair?
That's not unfair. The case does turn on the fact that Bell was outside in a public place when this arrest was trying to be effectuated, and that he fled from that warrant-based arrest. That's the inherent exigency justifying the hot pursuit entry.
That's it?
Yes.
But you're saying that because there were these other things going on, there was additional justification under the totality for them chasing into this third-party residence, correct?
It could be used as an additional justification, but the bare minimum facts that would be needed here is the fact that Bell was outside in a public place and he fled from a warrant-based arrest into the third.
As to that, the issue of the long-term investigation, the prior CDS offense, in quotes, is irrelevant. Not factoring into anything, is it? I mean, that seems to be what you're saying.
It's irrelevant to the hot pursuit entry, but it's relevant to why it was objectively reasonable for them to be there at 1 in the morning.
But that's not really our issue. And I'll let you deal with that if you want to, but my real question is, other than a representation, and kind of picking up on what the chief was asking, other than a representation from some of the officers involved, that they were culminating a long-term investigation in which he was a subject, I think you
suspect.
Said? Suspect. Mm-hmm. And the two-hour prior transaction that they saw, they were entitled to pursue him into the under the totality of circumstances analysis to pursue him into a third-party residence. All of that comes together to give them their justification. Is that an argument you're making? I thought that was, but apparently I may not be.
It is, as Your Honor first stated, the fact of the investigation and the CDS offense is essentially not needed to justify the hot pursuit entry, because it was reasonable to go to Bell's home. It would have been reasonable to go to Bell's home, and if he was outside, try to affect the warrant-based arrest. And that's essentially what the officers did. They went to his home. Bell was outside in a public place. The detectives tried to effect that warrant-based arrest in a public place, and it's Bell's actions that took it into a private home.
All we need to consider, your argument is, that's all we need to consider to determine that the police acted in an objectively reasonable way. The prior CDS, the long-term investigation, are essentially irrelevant.
Yes.
Okay.
Questions, anyone else? Anything you'd like to add?
I just have a few concluding remarks.
Thanks.
They're brief. First, the officers lawfully entered 1237 Thurman Street under this court's longstanding precedent of Jones. Second is that Lang, which merely adopted a standard that already existed in this state from both for decades, did not overrule Jones, a case that distinguished the warrantless arrest circumstances of Bolt and held that officers acting pursuant to a valid arrest warrant have the duty and right to pursue the fleeing subject into a private residence. Third, the hot pursuit entry here was even reasonable under Lang to prevent the high risk of Bell's imminent and likely escape, whose actions took this public encounter into a private place by defiantly fleeing into someone else's home. And fourth and final point is the state is asking this court to therefore affirm the appellate division's sound decision, which adhered to this court's longstanding precedent and aptly found that every step taken by the officers here in the swiftly unfolding sequence of events was objectively reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Randall. Brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few brief points on rebuttal. I think one of the most important aspects of the state's presentation is the acknowledgement that the applicable test in this case is the totality of the circumstances. That's not what the appellate division applied in determining that police pursuit of an individual with a valid arrest warrant justified warrantless entry into that third-party home. Neither is that what the state is arguing for here. The state agreed that a warrant alone does not permit entry into the home, that the only basis for the exigency in this case was flight from the execution of that warrant. And this court and the Supreme Court have said flight alone is not sufficient exigency to justify entry. And the state doesn't identify any other exigency and, in fact, admitted that the narcotics transaction and the long-term investigation are both irrelevant to this court's determination under the hot pursuit doctrine. And in fact, the state citation to this testimony that the motor vehicle investigation was concluding, I think as both Chief Justice and Justice Albin acknowledged, does not indicate there was probable cause to arrest for any crime and does not indicate what that crime might have been. With these facts and in this case, the police were not justified in entering 1237 Thurman Street, and therefore this court should reverse the appellate division decision and Mr. Bookman's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel for their